I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable, the day we speak with journalists about coverage of the week's news. On Tuesday, a massive explosion rocked Beirut and sent a giant mushroom cloud into the sky. The blast, which struck the city with a force comparable to a 3.5 magnitude earthquake, destroyed much of the country's main port. It flattened and damaged hundreds of buildings, including three hospitals, and a huge number of businesses and homes. The death toll tops 150 as the search for victims continues. Over 5,000 people have been injured. Over 300,000 have been displaced. Hundreds of people are still searching for the whereabouts of their loved ones. This comes as Lebanon is dealing with a major economic crisis and the COVID pandemic. Yesterday, Lebanon recorded 255 new cases, its single-day infection tally high. Joining us to discuss the latest is Habib Battah, an investigative journalist and founder of the Beirut Report. Habib has been covering Lebanon and the Middle East for 15 years. He's a regular contributor to Al Jazeera, BBC World, and other outlets. He also teaches journalism and media studies at the American University of Beirut. Hi, Habib. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hi there. Good to be with you.
Well, it was just surreal to see the blast on social media. I mean, the port, things just look so apocalyptic, like a bomb went off. What is the atmosphere like in the city? Now, the blast was on Tuesday. Today is Friday. What is the atmosphere like?
Well, it wasn't just a bomb. I mean, it was the mother of all bombs that we've never seen before. And if someone from Beirut tells you they've never seen a bomb blast like that, that's saying a lot, because we've lived through 20, 30 years of bombs. We've lived through American Buster bunker bombs dropped from Israeli planes. We've lived through massive amounts of dynamite to blow up our prime minister. For us to get rattled by this, it's something really amazing. It was like a mushroom cloud. It was almost on the level of, it felt like an atomic bomb from those old newsreels you see in Nevada. That's what it looked like. The shockwave just ripped apart, you know, miles and miles and miles of buildings that are just now falling apart now. So not only is the port leveled, but there are hundreds, if not thousands of buildings that are unlivable, that could collapse any moment. You know, the port area of Beirut is around the oldest part of Beirut. Some of those buildings are 100, 200 years old, beautiful architecture. They're all crumbling in the street now, giant boulders of sandstone that were used in the old days to build these buildings, of crushed vehicles. Now people are out there trying to help. It's been a really big community effort. There have been kind of tents set up all over, and volunteers are sweeping the streets. The government is nowhere to be found in the street. They have been, they say they've been leading the salvage operation at the port. The port is decimated. I mean, the port is a vein of any economy, but especially it's a life support of the Lebanese economy, because the Lebanese economy is bankrupt. So people have been feeling anxious, desperate. This has made everybody more angry. They were already reeling from economic catastrophe in this country, where our economy has fallen almost below Venezuela. Our money is almost worthless. People's savings and their salaries are almost worthless. They don't know how they were going to eat or survive. And then you had this explosion of all explosions that tore through the city. So it's a mixture of anxiety, anger, fear.
Lebanon is a country of about 7 million people, and then Beirut, are these numbers right? The metro area is about 2.2 million, and in the city about 361,000?
The city limits are hard to define. That 300,000 figure is very misleading, because those are old jurisdictions, voting jurisdictions, but really the city is about 1.5 million, and then the greater Beirut area, which is the city and the suburbs, is probably 2.5 million. About half the country's population lives there. And you should also understand that Beirut is one of the most densely populated cities, and Lebanon one of the most densely populated countries in the world. There aren't a lot of open spaces in Lebanon. People live literally living on top of each other. And so that's why there are so many neighborhoods that just literally ring the port of Beirut. And the major highway of the country, the only major highway, runs right past the port. I've driven past the port every day of my life almost. I was there on the day of the explosion, just 15 minutes before it exploded. So, you know, you really felt like this was, it's really, you know, whether your windows blew in, or you were outside the blast zone of the few kilometers, this really struck home for everybody. And the noise was so loud, it felt like the bomb had hit every building. It looks like the bomb has hit every building, that all the glass blown out, all these buildings, you know, many, many miles away. And everyone thought that they were being attacked. So, you know, it was a very traumatic experience. We have a flashback in Lebanon to so many wars we have lived through. I mean, it's just unbelievable how much the people in this country have been through. You know, the wars in this country, you can add them up, maybe 10, 15 wars in the last few decades in this country. So people are just wondering, you know, when are we going to get a break?
I listened to a few of the interviews you've done in the past couple of days, and you said that you actually had a shelling from Israel just a couple of days ago on the border.
Yeah, we were worried about a war with Israel before this, and before that, our economic catastrophe, and before that, our political instability. So yeah, Israel has, you know, always bombed Lebanon over the years. They've dropped God knows how many bombs and tons, thousands of bombs, actually, you know, on this country. And so there was a conflict between Hezbollah and Israel on the border. There have been many conflicts between the two parties over the years, and we were worried it was going to flare up, but fortunately, there was just some shelling, and it ended. This is a war of attrition that's been going on for years between Israel and Hezbollah over Lebanese land that the Lebanese government and Hezbollah feel is Lebanon's land that Israel's occupying. So, you know, we have multiple conflicts going on in this country, economic, political, military. The pandemic itself has been a huge disaster for Lebanon because we have so few ICU beds in the country. And now we've lost three hospitals. We've lost also big supplies of medical supplies at the port of Beirut, PPE, essential vaccines. So much has been lost. The loss is incredible. The loss is it's billions and billions of dollars. Some countries have offered aid, and we're very thankful and grateful for that. I think the U.S. just said that they're going to offer $10 million or $15 million, but we need $15 billion. So, you know, we're getting millions. And we need billions, and we need billions, and we're in a country with no economy. Why do we have an economy in Lebanon? Because we don't have peace in this country to have an economy. This country is always living off donations. And unfortunately, as corrupt and dysfunctional as the government, it's really a bunch of militias, but they are staying in power and they are enabled and legitimized by the international community, which supports different militias in Lebanon. The United States pours money into its allies. Iran pours money into its allies. France and Saudi Arabia the same. And we're constantly stuck with this cast of characters, these warlords, which are supported by big countries that have a lot of money and make weapons. And guess what? We don't make weapons. So when you see weapons used in the Middle East, they come from outside. You have to ask yourself where they come from and who is interested in really helping this country. And I think people are very, you know, skeptical of who claims to help Lebanon.
Habib, how are people coping? I mean, some people have said that they're afraid to go into their apartments. Al Jazeera reports that people need help to clean up the damage. There are pieces of glass that are dangling. And yet, as you said, so many people in interviews say the government is nowhere to be found. So what are you hearing from people?
People are angry. There's a big protest planned for tomorrow. They want revenge. They are outraged. And it's not just this, you know, we've been living with the power outages, with the lack of garbage collection, with lack of sewage treatment, with the lack of environmental protection, you know, forest fires unabated, you know, the number of disasters in Lebanon are just, and it's an endless list that people have gone through. So this is kind of like a moment where people have gotten more angry. Unfortunately, I'm not so optimistic about, you know, blind rage and anger and calls for revenge really going to be a way to get us out of this mess, because it is exactly the constant instability and war and violence in this country that has not allowed us to get out of it. But as you say, people have no homes. They say about 300,000 people cannot live in their homes. Many buildings might fall apart. People are just staying with their friends, relying on friends and neighbors. That has been our life in Lebanon. That's how we survive. People say that we're resilient and they want to clap for us, but we're not resilient. We're like any other people in the world. We've been beaten down with so many disasters that we just try to survive. And survival is also why we have this political system, because people will try to survive with any means necessary.
In interviews, you said that when the explosion happened, you were at a pharmacy several kilometers away. And at first you thought it was an airstrike. And then what happened?
Oh, I look up to the sky, and that's what we do in Lebanon. We look up to the sky all the time because we're constantly having planes over our head in Lebanon, enemy aircraft flying overhead. So we expect this kind of thing coming from the sky. And it wasn't just me, but there were so many people who did that. And actually, because people thought that they heard a plane, they took cover. And that actually saved some people's lives. And so I was there at a pharmacy, and I'd heard this thud, the soft thud, the initial explosion. There were several explosions. I looked away, and I kind of thought, oh, it must be just the sonic boom of an Israeli jet, as I've heard so many times in my entire life growing up here. And then I turned around to the pharmacist and continued to talk to her as nothing had happened. And then it just ripped me out of the doorway. I was like flung back almost a foot or so. My whole body was shaken like to my bones. I could feel it in my bones, the shock, the vibration. And it stayed with me for several hours. And I was very lucky. I was very far away. I just jumped in my car. I thought we were under attack. I wanted to get home as quickly as possible. People were driving erratically. People were walking outside their houses. Again, you know, this was we've been through so much, and this was just really something that no one should see. And I don't think very few people have seen a 2,700-ton ammonium bomb explode in a mushroom cloud fashion. It's just, you know, I think there have been disasters and these kind of things in other parts of the world when it comes to munitions factories, even in the U.S. But oftentimes these factories are, you know, way far away from public. And so we don't see the tragedy, but, you know, Lebanon again has no lack of space. So everything is kind of squeezed together, and we're in this tight squeeze of dysfunction and chaos. And it's a very difficult life.
To that point, you know, in the beginning, there were so many rumors and speculations about what triggered this massive chemical explosion. But in the past couple of days, we're learning about, according to so many reports, a shipment of 2,750 metric tons of ammonium nitrate that arrived in Beirut on a Russian-owned vessel in 2013. The ship was destined for Mozambique, but it stopped in Beirut and was stranded there, and it's been there ever since. How can you tell us more about this? What are you learning, and how could this have happened?
Well, we're all learning about this for the first time now. Flammable material stored in a port. I mean, you know, it was 6 years ago. It wasn't even made public. I mean, it was some kind of internal situation where a ship had been abandoned for some reason. I believe a Russian ship owner or Eastern European owner, was not really clear, brought the ship, was headed toward Mozambique. And somehow the ship got stranded, some kind of mechanical function, some are saying. Some are saying he went bankrupt and abandoned his ship. And the Lebanese authorities were saddled with another problem. What do we do with all this explosive material? They clearly didn't take it that seriously. But there was a lot of letters that were sent back and forth. We're now discovering journalists in Lebanon are now investigating this and reading these handwritten notes, because, again, Lebanon is so dysfunctional that all bureaucracy is handwritten. So can you imagine these handwritten notes? Please get rid of this toxic substance that could blow up. And these letters went on and on for years. You know, Lebanese courts are notoriously slow. Others will say there was foul play. But honestly, I'm not surprised, because, you know, everything else in this country is, not regulated. We have no regulations in this country. We have no safety precautions in this country. It just stood there. Apparently, they were trying to see if they can get rid of it by selling it. But then there was some kind of disagreement over who would be sold to. Apparently there was some fireworks that were stored nearby. We're still not clear how it happened. But you know, there have been some arrests now, some house arrests apparently, of some officials. People are not willing to wait for an investigation. They want revenge. They want blood. And that's a little bit of the worrying part. I think here we're kind of sliding into a bit of a populism of demanding people's heads and guillotines and this kind of thing, which is you know, not really the kind of thing you want to hear after another tragedy for a lot of people in this country. The political, you know, elite in this country, they're very entrenched. And any political system in the world, even the American system, is very entrenched. You cannot remove a political system overnight. We're faced with this very difficult situation in this country of dealing with these parties that have been around for so long. People have loyalties going back into the Civil War. People have died and sacrificed for these parties. We should not underestimate, the power of the political system in this country. There is a great hope of young people and even middle-aged people and old people who want a different system, who don't feel represented by the system. But it's hard to say if that's a critical mass big enough to overcome. And it's also groups that have no money. Activists in Lebanon don't have money. They don't have weapons. It would be pretty crazy to suggest a confrontation with these warlords who are very skilled at this kind of thing. We don't want to see another bloodbath in Beirut. But unfortunately, a lot of people look at the Middle East, Lebanon, and any country in a very reductionist way. They see us as simple problems, whether it's terrorism or Islam or corruption, these very simplistic categories we just assign, and just say the solutions are even more simple. Let's just overthrow the regime. Let's just bomb the country our way to democracy. So this very simple cause and effect that people read in the world, and increasingly a lot of activists, and you know, many of the activists again have been exposed to life in the West, and many are dual citizens. I think that people need to kind of take stock in of this situation before proceeding into the fire.
Such a good point. Today we're joined by Habib Battah, an investigative journalist and founder of the Beirut Report. He has been covering Lebanon and the Middle East for 15 years. If you have any questions or comments for Habib, you can give us a call. He'll be with us for about 10 more minutes. 866-798-8255. 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org or tweet us at yourcallradio. Habib, you've been talking a lot about what is happening in Lebanon, and you wrote a piece for Al Jazeera in May. Who is to blame for Lebanon's crisis? You write, it's not corruption nor sectarianism alone. The answer is much more complicated than that. You also say that Western media outlets, tend to say that the culprit is endemic corruption, and you say that that is too simplistic. So give us a little more context about, I mean, we'll definitely have you back for the full hour because we need more time to go deeper, but give us a little more information about how Lebanon got to a place where, as you say, you live on generators, you live on water reservoirs, the roads are dangerous, there are no traffic lights, there's really no government. So how did it get to this place?
Well, I think the problem with the word corruption is it depends on how you define it. And I think that's a global problem. I think that we think of corruption as third world places, dictators, etc. But, you know, we have lobbying in the U.S. That's a great way to pay your way to getting laws passed. But that's not considered corruption. And I think this word corruption, it really lacks the kind of detail that you need to really understand any problem. You know, if there was a massive explosion in the U.S., as there have been many times on occasion, we don't just say it's corruption, let's hang them all. You know, we say, let's look at the laws, let's look at the circumstances, let's look at the regulations, let's look at who was doing their job, let's look at so many players who are at work, who make policy happen. It's not just one or two men, but in the Middle East, we kind of see this simple, they're bad guys, they're corrupt. And what does corruption mean other than bad behavior? So it's a very strange way to diagnose a very complicated problem. And Lebanon is one of the most complicated problems that there could be. We have in this country 18 different sects. We have supporters of Iran and the United States living in the same country trying to form a government. We have more militias than anyone's ever seen. The car bomb was probably invented here. We've seen decades and decades and decades of war. It's the country is a chessboard for the world. All these countries can come now and claim to be our saviors and walk our streets and shake hands with the victims. However, they have been intimately involved with creating division in this country. So when we say corruption, we kind of point the finger at somebody that's not us, right? Just like we do with terrorism. We kind of dehumanize this topic. It's just a bunch of evildoers, whether they're corrupt or terrorists or whatever they are. And we have nothing to do with it. You know, the United States has nothing to do with it. I mean, and that's not true. That's not true at all. All these countries, Lebanon's a colonial product. You know, Lebanon's a country that doesn't really make sense at all because France created Lebanon, modern Lebanon at least, in a way that suited French colonial interests. And that meant putting Christians in control of most things in the country, giving Christians the upper hand as the president, as a majority in parliament, the head of the military. And, you know, obviously this wasn't going to sit well with the country's Muslims, who were a major part of the country. And, you know, we fought endless wars because of this. And so to kind of wash your hands and say, oh, what are those Middle Easterners doing over there? They're so corrupt. It's really a great way of taking yourself out of the equation. And in our world today, in our global economy, and our currency crisis is a great example of that. No one lives alone in this world. All of us are rated and scrutinized and evaluated by international credit ratings agencies, financial markets, societies. The United States has put sanctions on Lebanon. The United States has not allowed Lebanese airplanes or American airplanes to land in each other's countries, which is very harmful thing to the economy. So many Lebanese Americans obviously wouldn't have to waste all of that money going to other countries. So, you know, United States has worked actively to paint Beirut as a war zone that should not be visited, and over so many years of travel warnings. So you can't come and say you're trying to help us, and the United States government comes and plants a few trees here and there, and then they do a little tourism campaign. And it's just like, well, what about all the other things? You know, what about the 1 million cluster bombs that were dropped on Lebanon in the 2006 war, U.S.-made bombs that killed so many people? So I think that we need to really understand our role in the Middle East. I mean, as the Western countries, and I lived in the U.S. for a long time, so I think that people aren't really aware of that, that we can play an intimate role in all of these conflicts. And by using words like corruption, we're able just to point a finger at something that is foreign, that is other, that is outside of us, and we can define ourselves against that as being the more modern liberal democracy by comparison. But as we've seen with the Black Lives Matter protests, not all Americans are created equal. So I think we should really take stock of that.
We have a few questions from listeners about how people can help. And another listener wants to know if you can repeat what you said about what the United States so far has agreed to give in dollars.
I just heard a figure very briefly about, I think, $15 million. This doesn't even scratch the surface, but you know, we're grateful. We need it. What can we say? We need aid in this country. We beggars can't be choosers, unfortunately. And we have been a begging nation because we cannot really put our nation together. It's a small amount. I mean, we're talking about 200,000 people, 300,000 people almost with no homes. So people need glass. They need windows. They need floors. People need jobs in this country. They need business. They need the economy. I mean, you know, teach a man to fish. You can give us a little bit of aid here and there, but how are we going to move on this way so that we continue to be in the grasp of colonial powers? I don't know if countries really want what's best for Lebanon. Some people have said that France's French president came to Lebanon yesterday, and that France might be interested in, you know, using that great PR visit as a way to rebuild the port of Beirut. So now there'll be a competition probably between world powers over who will rebuild the port of Beirut and reap the benefits of that. So we're always in debt to the world monetarily. We're in debt billions and billions of dollars. Lebanon is the third most indebted country in the world, according to some lists. It's got the debt is so massive. There's almost no way we could recover from it. I think what really Lebanon needs is major assistance, not bits of grain and food, but, you know, obviously that's important, as well. People need shelter. People need, to put their lives back together. The government is broke and bankrupt and can't be there. We have no FEMA. There's no FEMA to help you. Imagine that. Imagine an American disaster or hurricane or something where there was no government response. There was no National Guard. People just had to get out there with brooms and sweep their own houses and streets. So people need all kinds of things. You know, everything you can imagine someone would need after losing their home. Imagine all these businesses, all these mom and pop businesses. Lebanon's full of mom and pop businesses, not corporate chains. And they're little restaurants and cafes and bars and supermarkets. And just thousands of them have been devastated. You know, one room shops, everything's blown out. Who's going to help them? So people need all kinds of help. I've said a lot of bad things, but Lebanon's also a beautiful country. You know, it's got mountains, it's got beaches, it's got everything. It's got ruins, it's got every kind of history. People, you know, could support Lebanon eventually by visiting, and being a tourist, not in a way that helps the society. So people need all kinds of economic support primarily, and not just temporary aid.
And two last questions. How is this affecting Palestinian and Syrian refugees?
Well, that is some of the worst off people in Lebanon are the refugees, because, again, Lebanon can't even provide for its own citizens, let alone refugees. And there have been a lot of xenophobia in some cases over the years. Lebanon holds the most refugees in the world per capita. Again, for a totally falling apart country, it's interesting that that burden is placed on Lebanon when the war producing countries and the weapons producing countries who have contributed to these wars don't really take many refugees, like the United States and Western Europe. They don't take any refugees in comparison to Lebanon. So that's another area where people can also help and pressure their governments on arms, on refugees, and doing more better behavior, if we don't want to call it corrupt behavior like we call it in the Middle East. So, you know, there's a lot people can help with. I mean, you know, the hospitals, anything you can do can help, you know, at this point. I mean, the Lebanese Red Cross, you can donate to them. The hospitals are in need of medicines. Doctors are in need. Our doctors are exhausted. They've been working for 50, 60 hour shifts. They've seen so much trauma and tragedy and gore than anyone could ever see in their life. And again, this is not just now, but for so many years. So the world should really help Lebanon, I think, because Lebanon has done a lot for the world in terms of its political agendas.
Well, Habib, thank you so much for joining us, and our best to you and your family and your friends. And we would love to have you back for a longer show.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Habib Bataa is an investigative journalist and founder of the Beirut Report. He's been covering Lebanon and the Middle East for 15 years. And you can find a link to his work, and we'll also add a link to the Lebanon Red Cross on our website, yourcallradio.org. This is Your Call's Media Roundtable. Coming up after a break, we will talk about the one-year anniversary of the deadly shooting at a Walmart in El Paso, Texas. We'll be back after this.